I'd like to share with you two readings this morning. The first is a clipping from the Washington Post of a few years back. At the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Station, on a cold January morning in 2007, the man with a violin played six Bach pieces for about 45 minutes. During that time, approximately 2,000 people went through that station, most of them on their way to work. After 3 minutes, a middle-aged man noticed there was a musician playing. He slowed his pace and stopped for a few seconds and then hurried to meet his schedule. 4 minutes later, the violinist received his first dollar. A woman threw the money in the hat and, without stopping, continued to walk. After 6 minutes, a young man leaned against the wall to listen to him, then looked at his watch and started to walk again. At 10 minutes, a 3-year-old boy stopped, but his mother tugged him away almost hurriedly. The kid stopped to look at the violinist again, but the mother pushed hard, and the child continued to walk, turning his head back all the time. This action was repeated by several other children. Every parent, without exception, forced their children to move on quickly. For 45 minutes, the musician played continuously. Only 6 people stopped and listened for a short while. About 20 gave money, but continued to walk at their normal pace. The man collected a total of $32. He finished playing, and silence took over. No one noticed. No one applauded, nor was there any recognition. No one knew this, but the violinist was Joshua Bell, one of the greatest musicians in the world. He played one of the most intricate pieces ever written with a violin worth $3.5 million. 2 days before, Joshua Bell sold out a theater in Boston where the seats averaged $100. This is a true story. Joshua Bell playing incognito in the metro station was organized by the Boston Post as a part of a social experiment about perception, taste, and people's priorities. The questions raised in a commonplace environment, a good question, do we perceive beauty? And I would like to share with you a poem by the poet William Stafford. The poem he called, "Who Are You Really, Wanderer?" If you were exchanged in the cradle and your real mother died without ever telling the story, then no one knows your name. And somewhere in the world, your father is lost and needs you, but you are far away. He can never find how true you are, how ready. When the great wind comes and the robberies of the rain, you stand on the corner shivering. The people who go by, you wonder at their calm. They miss the whisper that runs any day in your mind. Who are you really, wanderer? And the answer you have to give, no matter how dark and cold the world around you is, maybe I'm a king. I invite us to join together in a time of reflection, of prayer, of meditation. To take this opportunity amidst the run of business in our lives, to open our minds and open our hearts to that spirit that moves within us and continually beckons us to notice who we are and who we can become and who we shall not be anymore. Let us take this precious opportunity to be appreciative of the time we have to reflect together in silence with others sharing this journey with us, knowing that silence is richer in its sharing. Let us open our hearts to all those around us who are dear and who may be in a difficulty or challenge this day, as well as to those around this globe who are facing trauma and difficulties of one kind or another, and even to the non-human creatures on this planet Earth. In this silence, may we rest, knowing and paying attention to that deep resource in us which calls us and beckons us and oftentimes challenges us to leave behind where we were, the places we have known, and enter into a vast opportunity as yet unperceived. May we be together in a short time of quiet. So be it. Amen. Blessed be. I want to say how grateful I am to be with you this morning. It is a fortunate opportunity for me to be here this year. I was here about the same time last August to have the help of Anne as a liturgist in putting together the service this morning. And I have a feeling of gratitude to your director of education, who had the hardship of performing a wedding in Cape May, and asked if I would be kind enough to substitute for Judy Tomlinson this morning. And it's good to be back with you. There was a picture in a Seattle newspaper recently that showed a man behind bars, and the caption underneath explained that the police had caught him with a dispatch case full of papers and cards that claimed all kinds of identities. And the police had searched and found out that he was none of these. That was what they knew. The problem was they couldn't figure out who he was. Whenever they would question him, he would say, "I know who I am. You're the ones who arrested me. Who I am is your problem." The police sergeant is quoted in the paper as saying, "This man has boggled our system." Whenever I'm asked to define myself, I remember this story. I'm reminded of how much we identify ourselves and others by external tags and by internal ones as well. A friend of mine has a daughter. She's 39 years old. He calls her every week to chat. Recently, he called her. She picked up the phone. He said, "Hello." There was a silence at the other end. Then she asked, "Who is this?" He was so taken aback by her response that it took him a minute to catch his breath, and then he asked, "What do you mean, who is this? I'm your father." "Oh," she apologized, and she explained she'd just gotten a new phone with caller ID and was going by the number and didn't recognize his voice. Naturally, we identify ourselves and each other by a composite of particular characteristics that stand out or that we are especially interested in. To some, I know I may be seen as a minister, maybe a ballroom dancer, an old person, a student of Buddhist psychology, who knows? And inwardly, I may identify myself as a searcher, some with a person with certain stories, some sad, some of whimsy. But none of these capacities really do they define me. We tend to identify with our personalities, how we are seen and how we see ourselves. Interestingly enough, the very word personality comes from the Greek persona. The persona was a mask that the actors put on in the great Greek dramas. They put on masks in order to disguise their real selves. So they would see, the actors would see through the character of their masks, and they would in turn be seen by the audience only, not as themselves, but as the character in the drama. Similarly, we wear our disguising masks all the time, just like those Greek actors. We perceive others through these, and we see ourselves through the parts we play. And we have a lot of internal parts we play as well as external, don't we? We play out these as if they were external. We may play out the part and see ourselves as, for example, a happy person, a sick person, a caring person, one who has suffered a great deal of injustice, a person who feels deeply. All of these are the parts we play inside ourselves. And like actors who sometimes lose themselves when they're off stage, we can get hooked into our internal dramatis personae and forget who we are. We might be more than we can imagine. Thinking of who we are is to think of the number one question that pervades our life on this planet. And pursuing an answer to this question, who are we, can lead us into a deep mystery. The further we probe, the more mystery we may encounter. Each one of us will want to decide how far he or she is willing to explore in this journey, amazing journey. And this exploration will feel perhaps threatening, or it may appear exciting. And how do I find out who I am anyway? René Descartes offered, "I think, therefore I am." But he never thought to ask who was doing the thinking. Nor did he dare, "I think, therefore I think I am," which would have been a lot more accurate. As one historian quipped, the problem was with Descartes, he stopped thinking for a moment and he died. Personally, though, I like George Carlin. He said, "I think, therefore I am, I think." And then there's a sarcastic take that an intelligent woman friend of mine made recently. "I think, therefore I'm single." Now, the idea of thinking who we are doesn't take us too far. And one thing for sure, it has a lot to do more to do with our thoughts, who we are. Have you ever had the experience of gazing into the eyes of a very wise person or a very extremely loving person or maybe a saint, that you were someone you would call a saint in your life? If you have, you will have experienced that that person is not seeing you through the lens of his personality at all, or stopping at the limits of your personality. He is seeing into you, or she, much deeper. His or her gaze will feel more like a loving mirror that is held up to you. And in that moment of connection, there is just pure seeing without any intervening definition. This is what we call an act of love. It is the greatest blessing we can experience. Now, our masks often deceive us from this act. They, of course, do also serve us. They are snapshots that we carry around so that when we meet one another, we don't have to learn about each other from scratch. But we have to be so careful that we do not substitute our maps for the territory and to miss out on the loving. We are not only our personalities either, our idiosyncrasies, our preferences. We are also part of groups. I am a man or a woman, a human being. I am a Christian, a Jew, a Muslim, a UU, or some combination. And just as we spin beliefs about ourselves, we spin myths about our countries, our other external affiliations, our culture, our history, our religion. We construct our Christian identity, do we not? Our Jewish identity, our Muslim identity, even our UU identity. I'm no exception. I grew up in the Presbyterian Christian church, and then I got to a point where I identified myself as being a humanist, and then a humanist UU, and about 10 years ago, I began to define myself as a UU Buddhist, mainly because I liked and appreciated the way the Buddha encouraged us to live beyond our definitions and beliefs. In fact, it was in recognition of this teaching of the Buddha that the saying arose, if you see someone who thinks of himself as a Buddha or whom you uphold as a Buddha, you should kill him. In other words, you should kill that image that you identify with. And that sounded really good to me and made me consider myself a UU Buddhist until I realized I had identified with being a UU Buddhist. We can liberate ourselves from our identifications, both personal and religious, and we can open ourselves to a deeper capacity for appreciating life as the children did with Joshua Bell, and a deeper opportunity for loving. Thich Nhat Hanh is a well-known Buddhist monk who grew up in Vietnam. And he was expelled by both sides during the war in Vietnam because he wouldn't identify with either. During the war, a reporter once asked him, did he not favor that the South would continue to fight for victory because it might preserve Buddhism? Thay, as he is affectionately called, responded that Buddhism does not mean that we should sacrifice people's lives in order to preserve its persona, the hierarchy, the pagodas, the monasteries, the scriptures, or the rituals. Thich Nhat Hanh said he believed that the Buddhist values of peace and loving kindness will emerge naturally in humankind, and so he was willing to sacrifice his religious identity, which might come with the success of the South Vietnamese, for this deeper truth. It is this deeper truth that matters. We are so much more than we have thought we were. Our identities can be good or they can be bad, but whether a good or bad, every one of them is incomplete. And though our just identifications help us to stabilize our lives, they also seduce us from the depth of living. The precious thing about evolving into a human being is that though we live largely from our identities, we can also live beyond them. My mother was a personal inspiration to me in this way. She sort of fit the stereotype of a stoical type woman. She, a strict Presbyterian, she was a Southern lady and a dignified member of the DAR. But she was also curious and kind. However, I never saw her angry, and I saw her cry only once in my life. That was when I came home from college one Christmas and told her I had become a Unitarian. Until that time, she had simply considered me a lost sheep. Now she had to face the fact that from her perspective, I literally joined up with the devil. And I think this was perhaps the greatest shock of her life. But she changed. She never became a Unitarian Universalist, but she grew understanding of who we are, so much so that she could comfortably worship with us, in her perspective, the unsaved, even on Christmas and Easter, occasions which we are not known to make so much of the Savior with whom her life was so closely identified. And she enjoyed getting to know members of my first congregation in Massachusetts. This congregation later dismissed me over my protest of the Vietnam War, and it was my mother who defended me and came forthrightly to speak up for me. Not only can we live more deeply through our personal identity than living through only with our personal identities, our identification with the land, or our religious identity, we can even live beyond our theological identity. I can think of no more astringent identity conflicts and an example of this than those conflicts that occurred during the Holocaust. When we remember the Holocaust, we might remember Iti Halesian. She was a Jew living in Amsterdam as the Nazis took over. Her diary has been published under the title An Interrupted Life. One day, she made an entry in this diary that she referred to as her Sunday morning prayer. She wrote, "Dear God, these are anxious times. Tonight, for the first time, I lay in the dark with burning eyes as scene after scene of human suffering passed before me. I shall promise you one thing, God, just one very small thing. I shall never burden my today with cares for my tomorrow, although it takes some practice. Each day is sufficient unto itself. I shall try to help you, God, to stop my strength from ebbing away, though I cannot vouch for it in advance. But one thing has become increasingly clear to me, that you cannot help us, that we must help you to help ourselves. And that is all we can manage these days," she continues, "and all that really matters, that we safeguard that little piece of you, God, in ourselves, and perhaps in others as well. Alas, there doesn't seem to be much," she said, "that you yourself can do about our circumstances, about our lives. Neither do I hold you responsible. You cannot help us, but we must help you and defend your dwelling place inside us to the last." Edie wrote about this time that in the midst of this trauma, she was happy and at peace. She was able to live beyond identifications. She was able, for example, to resist identifying with being a humiliated Jew. Such a temptation at that time. She also resisted becoming one who hates Nazis, another great temptation of the time, and one that most of her friends took to. And finally, she resisted becoming one whose identity is that of being forgotten of God. She chose to live beyond these categories and many more. She wrote these words. She says, "We have to rid ourselves of all preconceptions, of all slogans, of all sense of security, and find the courage to let go of everything, every standard, every conventional bulwark. Only then will life become infinitely rich and overflowing, even in the midst of the suffering it deals out to us." Disidentifying herself led Iti Halesian to a profound love. She volunteered to go to Auschwitz and to help her friends who were being taken there. And there she was killed in 1943. Her near to final words were, In a labor camp, I should die within 3 days. I should lie down and die and still not find life unfair. It is not easy to unthink who we think we are. Sometimes we can hold on to a long time who we think we are, and to our hopes and to our grudges. Now, the following story makes this last point a bit comically. It seems an elderly woman died, and she was never married, and she requested at her funeral that there not be any pallbearers in handwritten instructions. So, being curious, they examined her request to see exactly what she had written, and these were the words she put down. She said, "They wouldn't take me out when I was alive. I don't want them to take me out when I'm dead." When we believe our stories are long-lasting and we can't let go of them, we fall into such a place. We fall into a small self. We do this not only when we're telling our stories. We do this when we tell our stories about persons and places. Now, there are no identities more tenacious today than those I think of between Israelis and Palestinians. And so I pray somehow that each can discover a larger vision beyond their long identifying histories and their intense identification with the land. This is the only way out I know. And it is not easy, because such an extension of de-identifying ourselves feels literally like death. It is truly a kind of death. It is a death of definitions. Maybe in this case, those which have lasted for thousands of years. But it is the death that leads to birth and to fullness of life that Edie Hilesium experienced. It is a life larger than any we might even imagine. In 1998, on Good Friday, after almost 700 years of fighting, the British Protestants and Irish Roman Catholics signed a treaty. George Mitchell, who led the negotiations, said, "I told them that their challenge was to come up with words that neither side identifies with." What a simple request, and how transformative it was between the Protestants and the Catholics. New discoveries lie beneath these stories of ours. If we are lucky, we can boggle our own system. Revelation, as we Unitarians have long said, is not sealed. Who we are, we will never find fully in our scriptures, our creeds, or in our holy locations. We will find it is beyond all of these. Where is our holy land, as we sang in the hymn this morning? Within the human soul. Where is our holy writ? It's within the human heart. As Ed Wilson, who wrote that song, a minister I knew from my theological days, continued to write, "Where is our paradise? In aspiration's sight, where we hope to see arise 10,000 years of light." Each of us is challenged, are we not, to live without identification. When we argue with each other, our spouse with spouse, friend with friend, employer and supervisor, landlord and tenant, and so forth, can we loosen our habits to who we think we are and who we think we are at that very moment of conflict? May we learn to live lightly with our identities. Acknowledging their convenience, yes, but without confirming their completeness. May we acknowledge that our identities help us to know about each other, but remember that they inhibit our getting to know each other and ourselves, even more importantly, and certainly ourselves as we would like to become. Within us, there is a potential yet unrealized, and too vast even perhaps to imagine or to declare, daringly and lovingly seeking realization that will express itself as love. My prayer is that we may escape who we think we are, because a larger possibility awaits us. I invite us to join hands in closing, recognizing the uniqueness of the people in whose hands we are holding this day, and recognizing the uniqueness of the person who is ourselves doing the holding, celebrating this uniqueness, and recognizing that amidst our diversity, there still is a unity that binds us all together in spite of death and space and time and the space between the stars. Let us pause in recognition of that unity. So may we leave this place experiencing love in our hearts, opened to beauty, aware of what we and the world can become, and may our hands be available to shape this world and our planet toward strength and justice. Our service ends, our worship service ends, and our real service in the world begins. Amen.